more likely to happen in worlds where he's alive than worlds where he's dead. But it's not strong Bayesian evidence. It's not something that can't possibly happen unless the Dark Lord is alive. Professor Quirrell, who didn't start from the assumption that you-know-who was still around, had no trouble thinking of his own explanation. To him, it was obvious that some powerful wizard might want Bellatrix Black because she knew a secret of the Dark Lord's, like some of his magical knowledge that he'd told to only her. The priors against anyone surviving their body's death are very low, even if it's magically possible. Most times, it doesn't happen. So, if it's just the Azkaban breakout, I'd have to say formally that it isn't enough Bayesian evidence. The improbability of the evidence, assuming that the hypothesis is false, is not commensurate with the prior improbability of the hypothesis.
No, Severus said flatly. The prophecy is not yet fulfilled. I would know if it were.
Are you sure of that?
Yes, Potter. If the prophecy had already come true, I would understand it. I heard Trelawney's words. I remember Trelawney's voice. And if I knew the events that matched the prophecy, I would recognize them. What has already happened does not fit.
The potions master spoke with certainty.
I'm not really sure what to do with that statement, Harry said.
His hand rose up, absently rubbed at his forehead.
Maybe it's just what you think happened that doesn't fit, and the true history is different.
Voldemort is alive, Albus said. There are other indications.
Such as?
Harry's reply was instant. Albus paused.
There are terrible rituals by which wizards have returned from death,
Albus said slowly.
That much anyone can discern within history and legend. And yet, those books are missing. I could not find them. It was Voldemort who removed them, I am sure.
So, you can't find any books on immortality, and that proves that you know who has them?
Indeed, said Albus. There is a certain book, I will not name it aloud, missing from the restricted section of the Hogwarts library. An ancient scroll which should have been at Borgin and Burke's, with only an empty space on a shelf to show where it was.
The old wizard stopped.
But I suppose,
the old wizard said, as though to himself,
you will say that even if Voldemort tried to make himself immortal, it does not prove that he succeeded.
Harry sighed.
Proof, Headmaster? There are only ever probabilities. If there are known particular books on immortality rituals which are missing, that increases the probability that someone attempted one, which in turn raises the prior probability of the Dark Lord surviving his death. This I concede, and thank you for contributing the fact. The question is whether the prior probability goes up enough.
Surely,
Albus said quietly,
if you can concede even a chance that Voldemort survived, that is worth guarding against.
Harry inclined his head.
As you say, Headmaster. Though, once a probability drops low enough, it's also an error to go on obsessing about it. given that books on immortality are missing, and that this prophecy would sound somewhat more natural if it refers to the Dark Lord and I having a future battle, I agree that the Dark Lord being alive is a probability, not just a possibility. But other probabilities must also be taken into account, and in the probable worlds where you know who is not alive, someone else framed Hermione.
Foolishness, Severus said softly. Utter foolishness. The dark mark has not faded, nor has its master.
See, that's what I mean by formally insufficient Bayesian evidence. Sure, it sounds all grim and foreboding and stuff, but is it that unlikely for a magical mark to stay around after the Maker dies? Suppose the mark is certain to continue while the Dark Lord's sentience lives on, but a priori, we'd only have guessed a 20% chance of the Dark Mark continuing to exist after the Dark Lord dies. Then, the observation, the Dark Mark has not faded, is 5 times as likely to occur in worlds where the Dark Lord is alive as in worlds where the Dark Lord is dead. Is that really commensurate with the prior improbability of immortality? Let's say the prior odds were 100 to 1 against the Dark Lord surviving. If a hypothesis is 100 times as likely to be false versus true, and then you see evidence 5 times more likely if the hypothesis is true versus false, you should update to believing the hypothesis is 20 times as likely to be false as true. Odds of 100 to 1 times a likelihood ratio of 1 to 5 equals odds of 20 to 1 that the Dark Lord is dead.
Where are you getting all these numbers, Potter?
That is the admitted weakness of the method, Harry said readily. But what I'm qualitatively getting at is why the observation, the Dark Mark has not faded, is not adequate support for the hypothesis the Dark Lord is immortal. The evidence isn't as extraordinary as the claim.
Harry paused.
Not to mention that even if the Dark Lord is alive, he doesn't have to be the one who framed Hermione. As a cunning man once said, there could be more than one plotter and more than one plan.
Such as the defense, Professor? Severus said with a thin smile. I suppose I must agree that he is a suspect. It was the defense professor last year, after all, and the year before that, and the year before that.
Harry's eyes dropped back to the parchment in his lap.
Let's move on. Are we certain that this prophecy is accurate? Nobody messed with Professor McGonagall's memory, maybe edited or subtracted a line?
Albus paused, then spoke slowly.
There is a great spell laid over Britain, recording every prophecy set within our borders. Far beneath the most ancient hall of the Wizengamot, in the Department of Mysteries, they are recorded.
The Hall of Prophecy,
Minerva whispered. She had read about that place, said to be a great room of shelves filled with glowing orbs, one after another appearing over the years. Merlin himself had wrought it was said. The greatest wizard's final slap to the face of fate. Not all prophecies conduced to the good, and Merlin had wished for at least those spoken of in prophecy to know what had been spoken of them. That was the respect Merlin had given to their free will, that destiny might not control them from the outside, unwitting. Those mentioned within a prophecy would have a glowing orb float to their hand, and then hear the prophet's true voice speaking. Others who tried to touch an orb, it was said, would be driven mad, or possibly just have their heads explode. The legends were unclear on this point. Whatever Merlin's original intention, the Unspeakables hadn't let anyone enter in centuries, so far as she'd heard. Works of the ancient wizards had stated that later Unspeakables had discovered that tipping off the subjects of prophecies could interfere with seers releasing whatever temporal pressures they released. And so the heirs of Merlin had sealed this hall. It did occur to Minerva to wonder, now that she'd spent a few months around Mr. Potter, how anyone could possibly know that. But she also knew better than to ask Albus, in case Albus tried to tell her. Minerva firmly believed that you only ought to worry about time if you were a clock.
"The Hall of Prophecy," Albus confirmed lowly. "Those who are spoken of in a prophecy may listen to that prophecy there. Do you see the implication, Harry?"
Harry frowned.
"Well, I could listen to it. Or the Dark Lord. Oh, my parents. Those who had thrice defied him. They were also mentioned in the prophecy, so they could hear the recording?"
"If James and Lily heard anything different from what Minerva reported," Albus said evenly, "they did not say it to me."
"You took James and Lily there?"
Minerva said.
"Forks can go to many places," Albus said. "Do not mention the fact."
Harry was staring directly at Albus.
"Can I go to this Department of Mysteries place and hear the recorded prophecy? The original tone of voice might be helpful, from what I've heard."
Light glinted from the reflection of Albus's half-moon glasses as the old wizard slowly shook his head.
"I think that would be unwise," Albus said. "For reasons beyond the obvious, it is dangerous, that place which Merlin made. More dangerous to some people than others."
"I see,"
Harry said tonelessly, and looked back down at the parchment.
"I'll take the prophecy as assumed accurate for now. The next part says that the Dark Lord has marked me as his equal. Any ideas on what that means exactly?"
"Surely not," said Albus. "That you must imitate his ways in any wise."
"I'm not dumb, Headmaster. Muggles have worked out a thing or two about temporal paradoxes, even if it's all theoretical to them. I won't throw away my ethics just because a signal from the future claims it's going to happen, because then that becomes the only reason why it happened in the first place. Still, what does it mean?"
"I do not know," said Severus.
"Nor I,"
she said. Harry took out his wand, turned it over in his hands, gazing meditatively at the wood.
11 inches, holly, with a core of phoenix feather," Harry said. "And the phoenix whose tail feather is in this wand only ever gave one other, which Mr. What was his name? Olive something. Made into the core of the Dark Lord's wand. And I'm a parcel mouth. It seemed like a lot of coincidence even then. And now I find out there's a prophecy stating that I'll be the Dark Lord's equal."
Severus's eyes were thoughtful, the headmaster's gaze unreadable.
"Could it be,"
Minerva said falteringly,
"that you know who, that Voldemort transferred some of his own powers to Mr. Potter the night he gave him that scar. Not something he intended to do, surely. Still, I don't see how Mr. Potter could be his equal if he had any less magic than the Dark Lord himself.
Eh, said Harry, still looking meditatively at his wand.
I'd fight the Dark Lord without any magic at all, if I had to. Homo sapiens didn't become the dominant species on this planet by having the sharpest claws or hardest armour, though I suppose some of that point may be lost on wizards. Still, it's beneath my dignity as a human being to be scared of anything that isn't smarter than I am. And from what I've heard, on that particular dimension, the Dark Lord wasn't very scary.
The Potions Master spoke, his voice taking on some of his customary contemptuous drawl.
You imagine yourself more intelligent than the Dark Lord, Potter?
Yes, in fact,
said Harry, pulling back the left sleeve of his robes and rolling up the shirt sleeve beneath to expose the bare elbow.
Oh, that reminds me. Let's make sure nobody here has the clearly visible tattoo in the standard, easily checkable location which would mark them as a secret enemy spy.
Albus made a quieting gesture that halted the potions master before he could say anything scathing.
Tell me, Harry, Albus said. How would you have crafted the dark mark?
Non-standard locations, Harry said promptly. Not easily found without embarrassment and fuss, though, of course, any security-conscious person would check anyway. Make it smaller, if possible. Overlay another non-magical tattoo to obscure the exact shape. Better yet, cover it with a layer of fake skin.
Cunning indeed, Albus said. But tell me, suppose you could craft any conditions you wished into the mark, fading it or raising it as you wished, what would you do then?
Make it completely invisible at all times,
Harry said in tones of stating the obvious.
You don't want there to be any detectable difference between a spy and a non-spy.
Suppose you are more cunning still, Albus said. You are a master of trickery, a master of deception, and you employ your abilities to the fullest.
Well,
the boy stopped frowning.
It seems unnecessarily complicated, more like a tactic a villain would use in a role-playing game than something you'd try in a real-life war. But I suppose you could put fake dark marks on people who aren't really Death Eaters, and keep the dark marks on the real Death Eaters invisible. But then there's the question of why people would start believing in the first place that the dark mark identified a Death Eater. I'd have to think about it for at least 5 minutes, if I were going to take the problem seriously.
I ask you this,
Albus said, still in that mild tone,
because I did, indeed, in the early days of the war, perform such tests as you suggested. The Order survived my folly, only because Alistair did not trust in the bare arms we saw. I had thought afterward that the bearers of the mark might hide it or show it at their will. And yet, when we hide Igor Karkaroff before the Wizengamot, that mark showed clear on his arm for all that Karkaroff wished to protest his innocence. What true rule may govern the dark mark, I do not know. Even Severus is still bound by his mark, not to reveal its secrets to any who do not know them.
Oh, well, that makes it obvious,
Harry said promptly.
Oh, wait, hold on. You were a Death Eater?
Harry transferred his stare to Severus. Severus returned a thin smile.
"I still am, so far as they know."
"Harry," said Albus, eyes only for the boy, "what do you mean? That makes it obvious."
"Information theory 101, the boy said in a lecturing tone. "Observing variable X conveys information about variable Y if, and only if, the possible values of X have different probabilities given different states of Y. The instant you hear about anything whatsoever that varies between a spy and a non-spy, you should immediately think of exploiting it to distinguish spies from non-spies. Similarly, to distinguish reality from lies, you need a process which behaves differently in the presence of truth and falsehood. That's why faith doesn't work as a discriminant while make experimental predictions and test them does. You say someone with the dark mark can't reveal its secrets to anyone who doesn't already know them. So, find out how the dark mark operates, write down every way you can imagine the dark mark might work, then watch Professor Snape try to tell each of those things to a confederate. Maybe one who doesn't know what the experiment is about. I'll explain binary search later so that you can play 20 questions to narrow things down, and whatever he can't say out loud is true. His silence would be something that behaves differently in the presence of true statements about the mark versus false statements. You see?
Minerva's mouth was hanging open, she realized, and she closed it abruptly. Even Albus looked surprised.
And after that, like I said, any behavioral difference between spies and non-spies can be used to identify spies. Once you've identified at least one magically censored secret of the Dark Mark, you can test someone for the Dark Mark by seeing if they can reveal that secret to somebody who doesn't already know it.
Thank you, Mr. Potter.
Everyone looked at Severus. The potions master was straightening, his teeth bared in a grimace of angry triumph.
Headmaster, I can now speak freely of the mark. If we know we are caught for a Death Eater, before others who have not yet seen our bare arms, our mark reveals itself whether we will it or no. But if they have already seen our arms bare, it does not reveal itself, nor if we are only being tested from suspicion. Thus, the dark mark seems to identify Death Eaters, but only those already found, you perceive.
Ah, Albus said. Thank you, Severus.
He closed his eyes briefly.
That would indeed explain why Black escaped even Peter's notice. Ah, well. And Harry's proposed test?
The potions master shook his head.
The Dark Lord was no fool, despite Potter's delusions. The moment such a test is suspected, the mark ceases to bind our tongues. Yet I could not hint at the possibility, but only wait for another to deduce it.
Another thin smile.
I would award you a good many house points, Mr. Potter, if it would not compromise my cover. But, as you can see, the Dark Lord is quite cunning.
His gaze grew more distant.
Oh, Severus breathed. He was very cunning indeed.
Harry Potter sat still for a long moment. Then,
"No,"
Harry said. The boy shook his head.
"No, that can't actually be true. First of all, we're talking about the kind of logic puzzle that would appear in Chapter 1 of a Raymond Smullyan book. Nowhere near the level of what Muggle scientists do for a living. And second, for all I know, it took the Dark Lord 5 months of thinking to invent the puzzle I just solved in 5 seconds."
"Is it that inconceivable to you, Potter, that anyone could be so intelligent as yourself?"
The potions master's voice held more curiosity than scorn.
"It's called a base rate, Professor Snape. The evidence is equally compatible with the Dark Lord inventing that puzzle over the course of 5 months or over the course of 5 seconds. But in any given population, there'll be many more people who can do it in 5 months than in 5 seconds."
Harry pasted a hand against his forehead.
"Darn it, how can I explain this? I suppose, from your perspective, the Dark Lord came up with a clever puzzle, and I cleverly solved it, and that makes us look equal."
"I remember your first day of potions class,"
the potions master said dryly.
"I think you have a ways still to go."
"Peace, Severus," Albus said. "Harry has already accomplished more than you know. Yet tell me, Harry, why do you believe the Dark Lord is less than you? Surely he is a damaged soul in many ways. But cunning for cunning, you are not yet ready to face him, I would judge. And I know the full tally of your deeds."
The frustrating thing about this conversation was that Harry couldn't say his actual reasons for disagreeing, which violated several basic principles of cooperative discourse. He couldn't explain how Bellatrix had really been removed from Azkaban. Not by you-know-who in any guise, but by the combined wits of Harry and Professor Quirrell. Harry didn't want to say in front of Professor McGonagall that the existence of brain damage implied that there were no such things as souls, which made a successful immortality ritual, well, not impossible. Harry certainly intended to forge a road to magical immortality someday, but it would be a lot harder and require much more ingenuity than just binding an already existent soul to a lich's phylactery. Which no intelligent wizard would bother doing in the first place, if they knew their souls were immortal. And the true and honest reason Harry knew the Dark Lord couldn't have been that smart, well, there wasn't any tactful way to say it, but Harry had been to a convocation of the Wizengamot. He had seen the laughable security precautions, if you could call them that, guarding the deepest levels of the Ministry of Magic. They didn't even have the thief's downfall, which goblins used to wash away polyjuice and imperious curses on people entering Gringotts. The obvious takeover route would be to imperious the Minister of Magic and a few department heads, and owl a grenade to anyone too powerful to imperious. Or owl them knockout gas if you needed them alive and in a state of living death to take hairs for polyjuice potions. Legilimency, false memories, the confunder's charm. It was ridiculous. The magical world was super-saturated with ways to cheat. Harry might not do any of those things himself during his own takeover of Britain, since he was constrained by ethics. Well, Harry
might do some of the lesser ones, since Polyjuice or a Temporary Confundus or Read-Only Legitimacy all sounded better than an extra day of Azkaban. But if Harry hadn't been constrained by ethics, it was possible he could have wiped out the eviler sections of the Wizengamot that day, all by himself, using only a first year's magical power, on account of being clever enough to figure out Dementors. Though Harry might not have been in such a great political position after that, the surviving Wizengamot members might have found it easy and cheap to disavow his actions for PR purposes, and condemn him, even if the smarter ones realized it was for the greater good. But still, if you were completely unrestrained by ethics, armed with the ancient secrets of Salazar Slytherin, had dozens of powerful followers, including Lucius Malfoy, and it took you more than 10 years to fail to overthrow the government of magical Britain, it meant you were stupid.
"How can I put this?" Harry said. "Look, Headmaster, you've got ethics. There's a lot of battle tactics you don't use because you're not evil. And you fought the Dark Lord, a tremendously powerful wizard who wasn't so restrained, and you held him off anyway. If you-know-who had been super smart on top of that, you'd be dead. All of you. You'd have died instantly."
"Harry,"
Professor McGonagall said. Her voice was faltering.
"Harry, we almost did all day. More than half the Order of the Phoenix died. If not for Albus. Albus Dumbledore, the greatest wizard in 2 centuries. Harry, we surely would have perished."
Harry passed a hand across his forehead.
"I'm sorry," Harry said. "I'm not trying to minimize what you went through. I know that you-know-who was a completely evil, incredibly powerful dark wizard with dozens of powerful followers, and that's bad. Yes, definitely bad. It's just, all that isn't on remotely the same threat scale as the enemy being smart, in which case they transfigure botulinum toxin to sneak a millionth of a gram into your teacup."
Was there any safe way to convey that concept without citing specifics? Harry couldn't think of one.
"Please, Harry,"
said Professor McGonagall.
"Please, Harry, I beg you, take the Dark Lord seriously. He's more dangerous than..."
The senior witch seemed to be having trouble finding words.
"He's far more dangerous than transfiguration."
Harry's eyebrows went up before he could stop himself. A dark chuckle came from Severus Snape's direction.
Said the voice of Ravenclaw within him.
Honestly, Professor McGonagall is right. We're not taking this as seriously as we'd take a scientific problem. The difficult thing is to react at all to new information, instead of just flushing it out the window. Right now, it looks like we didn't shift belief at all after encountering an unexpected, important argument. Our dismissal of Lord Voldemort as a serious threat was originally based on the Dark Mark being blatantly stupid. It would require a focused effort to de-update and suspect the whole garden path of reasoning we went down based on that false assumption. And we're not putting in that effort right now.
All right, Harry said, just as Professor McGonagall seemed to be about to speak again.
All right. To take this seriously, I need to stop and think for 5 minutes.
Please do,
said Albus Dumbledore. Harry closed his eyes. His Ravenclaw side divided into three.
"Probability estimate," said Ravenclaw One, who was acting as moderator, "that the Dark Lord is alive, and as smart as we are, and hence a genuine threat." "Why aren't all his enemies already dead?" said Ravenclaw Two, who was prosecuting. "Note," said Ravenclaw One, "we had already thought of that argument, so we can't use it to shift belief again each time we rehearse it." "But what's the actual flaw in the logic?" said Ravenclaw Two. "In worlds with a smart Lord Voldemort, everyone in the Order of the Phoenix died in the first 5 minutes of the war. The world doesn't look like that, so we don't live in that world. QED." "Is that really certain?" asked Ravenclaw Three, who'd been appointed as the defender. "Maybe there was some reason Lord Voldemort wasn't fighting all out back then." "Like what?" demanded Ravenclaw Two. "Furthermore, whatever your excuse, I demand that the probability of your hypothesis be penalized in accordance with its added complexity." "Let Three talk," said Ravenclaw One. "Okay, look," said Ravenclaw Three. "First of all, we don't know that anyone can take over the Ministry just with mind control. Maybe Magical Britain is really an oligarchy, and you need enough military power to intimidate the family heads into submission." "Imperious them too," interjected Ravenclaw Two. "And the oligarchs have thieves' downfall in the entrances to their homes." "Complexity penalty," cried Ravenclaw Two. "More epicycles." "Oh, be reasonable," said Ravenclaw Three. "We haven't actually seen anyone taking over the Ministry with a couple of well-placed Imperius curses. We don't know that it can actually be done that easily." "But," said Ravenclaw Two, "even taking that into account, it really seems like there should have been some other way. 10 years of failure? Really? Using only conventional terrorist tactics? That's just not even trying." "Maybe Lord Voldemort did have more creative ideas," replied Ravenclaw Three, "but he didn't want to tip his hand to other countries' governments, didn't want them to know how vulnerable they were and install thieves' downfall in their ministries. Not until he had Britain as his base and enough servants to subvert all the other major governments simultaneously." "You're assuming he wants to conquer the whole world," noted Ravenclaw Two. "Trelawney prophesies that he would be our equal," intoned Ravenclaw Three solemnly. "Therefore, he wanted to take over the world." "If he's your equal, and you do have to fight him..." For an instant, Harry's mind tried to imagine the spectre of two creative wizards fighting an all-out war against each other. Harry had noted all the charms and potions in his first-year books that could be creatively used to kill people. He hadn't been able to help himself. Literally, he'd tried to stop his brain from doing it each time, but it was like looking at a fish and trying to stop your brain from noticing it was a fish. What someone could creatively do with 7th year, or aura level, or ancient lost magic such as Lord Voldemort had possessed, didn't bear thinking about. A magically super-powered creative genius psychopath wasn't a threat, it was an extinction event. Then Harry shook his head, dismissing the gloomy line his reasoning had been going down. The question was whether there was a significant probability of facing anything so terrible as a dark rationalist in the first place. "Prior odds that someone attempting an immortality ritual would actually have it work. Call it 1 to 1,000 at a generous overestimate.
It was not the case that roughly one wizard in 1,000 survived their death. Though, admittedly, Harry didn't have data on how many had attempted immortality rituals first.
"What if the Dark Lord is as smart as us?"
said Ravenclaw 3.
"You know, the way Trelawney prophesied him being our equal. Then he would make his immortality ritual work. P.S., don't forget that destroy all but a remnant of the other line."
Requiring that level of intelligence was an additional burdensome detail. Prior odds of a random population member being that intelligent were low. But Lord Voldemort wasn't a randomly selected wizard. He was one particular wizard in the population who had come to everyone's attention. The puzzle of the mark implied a certain minimum level of intelligence, even if, hypothetically, the Dark Lord had taken longer to think it through. Then again, in the Muggle world, all of the extremely intelligent people Harry knew about from history had not become evil dictators or terrorists. The closest thing to that in the Muggle world was hedge fund managers, and none of them had tried to take over so much as a third world country, a point which put upper bounds on both their possible evil and possible goodness. There were hypotheses where the Dark Lord was smarter, and the Order of the Phoenix didn't just instantly die, but those hypotheses were more complicated and ought to get complexity penalties. After the complexity penalties of the further excuses were factored in, there would be a large likelihood ratio from the hypotheses "the Dark Lord is smart" versus "the Dark Lord was stupid" to the observation "the Dark Lord did not instantly win the war." That was probably worth a 10-to-1 likelihood ratio in favour of the Dark Lord being stupid, but maybe not 100-to-1. You couldn't actually say that "the Dark Lord instantly wins" had a probability of more than 99%, assuming the Dark Lord started out smart. The sum over all possible excuses would be more than 0.01. And then there was the prophecy, which might or might not have originally included a line about how Lord Voldemort would immediately die if he confronted the Potters, which Albus Dumbledore had then edited in Professor McGonagall's memory in order to lure Lord Voldemort to his doom. If there was no such line, the prophecy did sound somewhat more like you-know-who and the boy who lived were destined to have some later confrontation. But in that case, it was less likely that Dumbledore would have come up with a plausible-sounding excuse not to take Harry to the Hall of Prophecy. Harry was wondering if he could even get a Bayesian calculation out of this. Of course, the point of a subjective Bayesian calculation wasn't that, after you made up a bunch of numbers, multiplying them out would give you an exactly right answer. The real point was that the process of making up numbers would force you to tally all the relevant facts and weigh all the relative probabilities. Like realizing, as soon as you actually thought about the probability of the Dark Mark not fading, if you know who was dead, that the probability wasn't low enough for the observation to count as strong evidence. One version of the process was to tally hypotheses and list out evidence, making up all the numbers, do the calculation, and then throw out the final answer and go with your brain's gut feeling after you'd forced it to really weigh everything. The trouble was that the items of evidence weren't conditionally independent, and there were multiple interacting background facts of interest. Well, one thing at least was certain. If the calculation could be done at all, it was going to take a piece of paper and a pencil. In the fireplace at one side of the headmaster's office, the flames suddenly flared up, turning from orange to bright bilious green.
"Ah,"
said Professor McGonagall into the uncomfortable non-silence.
"That would be Mad A. Moody, I suppose."
"Let this matter bide for now,"
the headmaster said in some relief, as he too turned to regard the flu.
"I believe we're about to receive some news regarding it as well."
Hypothesis, Hermione Granger, April 8th, 1992, 6:53 p.m.
Meanwhile, in the Great Hall of Hogwarts, as the students who didn't have secret meetings with the headmaster bustled about their dinner around four huge tables...
"It's funny," Dean Thomas said thoughtfully. "I didn't believe the General when he said that what we learned would change us forever, and we'd never be able to return to a normal life afterward. Once we knew, once we saw what he could see..."
"I know," said Seamus Finnegan. "I thought it was just a joke, too. Like, you know, everything else General Chaos ever said, ever."
"But now," Dean said sadly, "we can't go back, can we? It'd be like going back to a muggle school after having been to Hogwarts. We've just got to stay around each other. That's all we can do, or we'll go crazy."
Seamus Finnegan, next to him, just nodded wordlessly and ate another bite of Veldbeest. Around them, the conversation at the Gryffindor table continued. It wasn't as relentless as it had been yesterday, but now and then the topic wandered back.
"Well, there must have been some sort of love triangle," said a second-year witch named Samantha Crowley.
She never answered when asked if there was any relation.
"The question is, which ways was it going before it all went wrong? Who was in love with who, and whether or not that person loved them back? I don't know how many possibilities there are."
64,
said Sarah Variable, a blossoming beauty who probably should have been sorted into Ravenclaw or Hufflepuff instead.
No, wait... "That's wrong. I mean, if nobody loved Malfoy and Malfoy didn't love anyone, then he wouldn't really be part of the love triangle. This is going to take arithmancy. Could you all wait 2 minutes? I, for one, think it's perfectly clear that Granger is Potter's Moirail, and that Potter was auspicing between Malfoy and Granger."
The witch who'd spoken nodded with the self-satisfaction of someone who'd just precisely nailed down a complicated issue.
"Those aren't even words,"
objected a young wizard.
"You're just making them up as you go."
"Sometimes you can't describe a thing using real words."
"It's so sad," said Charisse Nazarin, who actually had tears in her eyes.
They were just so obviously meant to be together."
"You mean Potter and Malfoy?"
said a second year named Colleen Johnson.
"I know. Their families hated each other so much, there was no way they couldn't fall in love."
"No, I mean all three of them," said Charisse.
This produced a brief pause in the huddled conversation. Dean Thomas was quietly choking on his lemonade, trying not to make any sounds as it trickled out of his mouth and soaked into his shirt.
"Wow," said a dark-haired witch by the name of Nancy Hua. "That's really sophisticated of you, Charisse."
"Look, you all, we need to keep this realistic,"
said Eloise Rosen, a tall witch who'd been general of an army and hence spoke with an air of authority.
"We know, because she kissed him, that Granger was in love with Potter. So, the only reason she'd try to kill Malfoy is if she knew that she was losing Potter to him. There's no need to make it all sound so complicated. You're all acting like this is a play instead of real life."
"But even if Granger was in love, it's still funny that she'd just snap like that,"
said Chloe, whose black robes combined with her night-black skin to make her look like a darkened silhouette.
"I don't know. I think maybe there's more to this than just a romance novel gone wrong. I think maybe most people haven't got any idea at all what's going on."
"Yes, thank you,"
burst out Dean Thomas.
"Look, don't you realize, like Harry Potter told us all, if you didn't predict that something would happen, if it took you completely by surprise, then what you believed about the world when you didn't see it coming isn't enough to explain..."
Dean's voice trailed off as he saw that nobody was listening.
"It's completely hopeless, isn't it?"
"You hadn't figured that out yet,"
said Lavender Brown, who was sitting across the table from her two fellow former Chaotix.
"How did you ever make Lieutenant?"
"Oh, you're to be quiet,"
Cherise snapped at them.
"It's obvious you both want the three of them for yourselves."
"I mean it," Chloe said. "What if what's really going on is different from all the, you know, normal things that all the ordinary people are talking about? What if somebody made Granger do what she did, just like Potter was trying to tell everyone?"
"I think Chloe's right," said a foreign-looking boy wizard who always introduced himself as Adrian Turnipseed, though his parents had actually named him Mad Drongo.
"I think this whole time there's been..."
Adrian lowered his voice ominously. "A hidden hand." Adrian raised his voice again.
"Shaping all that's happened. One person who's been behind everything from the beginning. And I don't mean Professor Snape either."
"You don't mean..."
gasped Sarah.
"Yes," Adrian said. "The real one behind it all is... Tracy Davis."
"That's what I think too," Chloe said. "After all..."
She glanced around rapidly.
"Ever since that thing with the bullies and the ceiling... Even the trees in the forest around Hogwarts look like they're shaking, like they're afraid."
Seamus Finnegan was frowning thoughtfully.
"I think I see where Harry gets his, you know, from,"
Seamus said, lowering his voice so that only Lavender and Dean could hear.
"Oh, I totally know what you mean,"
Lavender said. She didn't bother to lower her own voice.
"It's a wonder he didn't crack and just start killing everyone ages ago."
"Personally," Dean said, also in a quieter voice, "I'd say the really scary part is that could have been us."
"Yeah,"
said Lavender.
"It's a good thing we're all perfectly sane now."
Dean and Seamus nodded solemnly.
Hypothesis. GL. April 8th, 1992, 8:08 p.m.
The flue fire of the headmaster's office blazed a bright, pale green, the fire concentrating in on itself into a spinning emerald whirlwind, and then flared even brighter and spit a human figure into the air. There was a blur of motion as the resolving figure snapped up a wand, smoothly spinning with the flue's momentum like a ballet dance step so that his firing arc covered the entire 360-degree arc of the room. And then, just as abruptly, the figure stopped in place. In the first instant that Harry saw that man, before Harry even took in the eye, he noticed the scars on the hands, the scars on the face, like the man had been burned and cut over his entire body, though only the man's hands and face were visible of all his flesh. The rest of the man's body was hidden, encased not in robes, but in leather that looked more like armour than clothing. Dark grey leather,
matching the man's mess of greyed hair. The next thing that Harry's vision comprehended was the brilliant blue eye occupying the right side of the man's face. One part of Harry's mind realized that the person whom Professor McGonagall had named Mad Eye Moody was the same as the one Dumbledore had called Alistair, within the memory Dumbledore had shown Harry. An image from before whatever event had scarred every inch of the man's body and taken a chunk out of his nose. And another part of his mind noticed the jolt of adrenaline. Harry had drawn his wand in sheer reflex when the man had spun out of the flu like that. There'd been something about it that felt like ambush. Harry's hand had already started to level his wand for a somnium before he'd managed to stop himself. Even now, the armoured man was holding his wand level, not pointed at any particular person, but covering the whole room, and that wand was already in perfect line with his eyes, like a soldier sighting down a gun. There was a danger in the man's stance and the set of his boots. Danger in the leather armour he wore, and danger in that bright blue eye. When the scarred man spoke, addressing the headmaster, his voice was edged.
"I suppose you think this room is secure?"
"There are only friends here," Dumbledore said.
The man's head jerked toward Harry.
"That include him?"
"If Harry Potter is not our friend," Dumbledore said gravely, "then we are all certainly doomed, so we may as well assume that he is."
The man's wand stayed level, not quite pointing at Harry.
"By almost drew on me just then."
Harry said. He noticed that his hand was still tightly holding the wand, and consciously relaxed his hand and dropped it back to his side.
"Sorry about that. You looked a bit... combat ready."
The scarred man's wand moved slightly away from where it had almost pointed at Harry, though it didn't lower, and the man let out a short bark of laughter.
"Ha! Constant vigilance, eh, lad?"
said the man.
"It's not paranoia if they really are out to get you."
Harry recited the proverb. The man turned fully toward Harry, and insofar as Harry could read any expression on the scarred face, the man now looked interested. Dumbledore's eyes had regained some of that brilliant twinkle that they'd had before the Azkaban breakout. A smile beneath his silver moustache, as though that smile had never left.
"Harry, this is Alistair Moody, called also Mad Eye, who will command the Order of the Phoenix after me, if anything should happen to me, that is. Alistair, this is Harry Potter. I have every hope the two of you shall get along fantastically."
"I've heard a good deal about you, boy," said Mad-Eye Moody.
His one dark, natural eye stayed fixed on Harry, while the point of brilliant blue spun frantically, seeming to rotate all the way around within its socket.
"Not all of it good. Heard they are calling you the Dementor Spooker in the department."
After some consideration, Harry decided to reply with a knowing smile.
"How'd you pull off that one, boy?"
the man said softly. Now his blue eye was fixed on Harry as well.
"I had a little chat with one of the Irons who escorted the Dementor there from Azkaban. Beth Martin said it came straight from the pit, and no one gave it any special instructions along the way. Of course, she could be lying."
"There wasn't any sneaky trick to that one," Harry said. "I just did it the hard way. Of course, I could also be lying."
Dumbledore was leaning back in his chair, chuckling in the background, like he was just another device in the headmaster's office, and that was the sound he made. The scarred man turned back to face the headmaster, though his wand stayed pointed low and in Harry's general direction. When he spoke, his voice was gruff and businesslike.
"I have a lead on a recent host of Voldys. You're certain his shade is in Hogwarts now?"
"Not certain," Dumbledore began.
"Say what?"
Harry interrupted. After having nearly concluded that the Dark Lord didn't exist, it was a shock to hear it being discussed that matter-of-factly.
"Voldy's host," Moody said shortly. "The one he possessed before he took over Granger."
"If the tales speak true," Dumbledore said, "there is some device of power which binds Voldemort's shade to this world, and by that means he may bargain with a host for possession of their body, conferring on them some portion of his power and his pride."
"So, the obvious question is, who gained too much power too quickly?" Moody said abruptly. "And it turns out that there is a fellow who's gone and banished the Bandon Banshee, taken an entire rogue vampire clan in Asia, tracked down the Wagga Wagga werewolf, and exterminated a pack of ghouls using a tea strainer. And he's milking it for all it's worth. There's been talk of the Order of Merlin. Seems to have turned into a charmer and a politician, not just a powerful wizard."
"Dear me," murmured Dumbledore. "Are you certain that he is not relying on his own skills?"
"Checked his grades," Moody said. "Record shows Gilderoy Lockhart received a troll in his defense OWLs. Didn't bother with the NEWT. Just the sort of sucker to take the deal Voldy was offering."
The blue eye whirled crazily within its socket.
"Unless you remember Lockhart as a student, and think he had enough potential to do all that boy himself."
"No,"
said Professor McGonagall. She frowned.
"Not a chance, I should say."
"I fear I must agree," Dumbledore said with an undertone of pain. "Ah, Gilderoy, you poor fool."
Moody's grin was more like a snarl.
3 in the morning worked for you, Albus. Lockhart should be at his home tonight."
Harry listened to this with increasing alarm, wondering if even the Ministry had any rules about magistrates needing to issue warrants, never mind the illegal vigilante organization Harry now seemed to have joined.
"Excuse me," Harry said. "What exactly happens at 3 in the morning?"
There must have been something in Harry's voice that gave him away, because the scarred man whirled on him.
"You have a problem with that boy?"
Harry paused, trying to figure out how to phrase this to a stranger.
"You want to take him down yourself?"
pressed the scarred man.
"Get revenge for your parents, eh?"
No,
Harry said as politely as he could.
"Honestly, look, if we knew for certain he was a willing host for you-know-who, that's one thing. But if we're not sure, and you're heading off to kill him..."
"Kill!"
Mad-Eye Moody snorted.
"It's what's locked up in his head."
Moody tapped his forehead.
"That we need from him, boy. If we're lucky, Voldy can't wipe the sucker's memories as easy as in his living days, and Lockhart will remember what the Horcrux looks like."
Harry mentally noted down the word Horcrux for future research and said,
I'm just worried that someone innocent, what sounds like a pretty decent person, if he did do all that himself, might be about to get hurt.
Horrors hurt people, the scarred man said shortly. Bad people, if you're lucky. Some days you won't be lucky, and that's all there is to it. Just remember, dark wizards hurt a lot more people than we do.
Harry took a deep breath.
Can you at least try not to hurt this person, in case he's not?
What is a first year doing in this room, Elvis?
Demanded the scarred man, now whirling to face the headmaster.
And don't tell me it's for what he did when he was a baby.
Harry Potter is not an ordinary first year,
the headmaster said quietly.
He has already accomplished feats impossible enough to shock even me, Alistair. He is the only intellect in the order which might some day match that of Voldemort himself, as you or I never could.
The scarred man leaned over the headmaster's desk.
He's a liability. Naive. Doesn't know a bloody thing about what war's like. I want him out of here, and all his memories of the Order wiped before one of Voldy's servants plucks them straight out of his mind.
I'm an Occlumens, actually.
Mad-Eye Moody directed a narrow look at the headmaster, who nodded. And then the scarred man turned to face Harry, their gazes meeting. The sudden fury of the Legilimency attack almost made Harry fall off his chair, as a blade of white-hot steel cut into the imaginary person at the forefront of his mind. Harry hadn't had a chance to practice since Mr. Bester's training, and Harry very nearly lost his grip on the imaginary person the back of his mind was pretending to be, as that person's world turned into searing lava and a furious probe of questions. Harry almost lost his grip on only pretending to hallucinate, only pretending to be the imaginary person that was screaming in shock and pain as the Legilimency tore apart his sanity and reshaped him to believe that he was on fire. Harry managed to break eye contact, dropping his eyes to Moody's chin.
"You're out of practice, boy," Moody said.
Harry wasn't looking at the man's face, but his voice was deadly grim.
"And I'll warn you of this, but once. Voldy isn't like any other Legilimens in recorded history. He doesn't need to look you in the eyes, and if your shield are that rusty, he'd creep in so softly you'd never notice a thing."
"Duly noted,"
Harry said to the scarred chin. Harry was more shaken than he'd have admitted. Mr. Bester hadn't been anywhere near that powerful, and had never tested Harry like that. Pretending to be someone hurting that much had... Harry couldn't find words for describing what it felt like to contain an imaginary person in that much pain, but it hadn't been... normal.
"Do I get any credit for being an Occlumens in the first place?"
"So, you're thinking you're all grown up already, eh? Look me in the eyes."
Harry strengthened his shields and looked once more into the dark grey eye and the brilliant blue.
"Ever watched someone die?" asked Mad-Eye Moody.
"My parents," Harry said evenly. "I recovered the memory in January when I went in front of a Dementor to learn the Patronus charm. I remember you-know-whose voice."
A chill went through Harry's body, his wand twitching in his hand.
My main tactical report is that you-know-who could speak the killing curse in less than half a second, but you probably already knew that.
There was a gasp from Professor McGonagall's direction, and Severus's face had tightened.
All right,
Mad-Eye Moody said softly. A strange, thin grin twisted up the lips within the scarred face.
I'll make you the same offer I'd make to any trainee horror. Land one touch on me, boy. One hit. One spell. And I'll concede your right to talk back to me.
Alistair!
Exclaimed Professor McGonagall's voice.
Surely that's an unreasonable test. Mr. Potter, whatever his other merits, does not have 100 years of fighting experience.
Harry's eyes made a lightning dart around the room, passing over the peculiar devices, glancing past Dumbledore and Severus and the Sorting Hat, settling briefly here and there. Harry couldn't see Professor McGonagall from where he was, but that didn't matter. There was only one device he'd really wanted to look at, and the point of all the other glances had just been to conceal which one.
All right,
Harry said, and hopped off his chair, ignoring Professor McGonagall's inhalation and the potion master's snort of disbelief. Dumbledore's eyebrows had lifted, and Moody was grinning like a tiger.
Be sure to wake me up in 40 minutes if he does get me.
Harry settled into a duelist's starting stance, his wand held low.
Let's go, then!
Harry opened his eyes, his head feeling like it had been stuffed with cotton wool. Everyone else was gone from the headmaster's office. The flue fire dimmed, only Dumbledore still waiting behind the desk.
"Hello, Harry,"
the headmaster said quietly.
"I didn't even see him move,"
Harry marvelled, muscles creaking as he sat up.
"You were standing 2 paces away from Alistair Moody,"
said Dumbledore,
"and you took your eye off his wand."
Harry nodded as he took the cloak of invisibility out of his pouch.
"I mean, I was taking the dueling stance so that he'd think I was a standard idiot and underestimate me. But I have to admit, that was impressive."
"So, you planned it all along, Harry,"
Dumbledore said.
"Of course," Harry said. "Note how I'm doing this as soon as I wake up, rather than pausing to think of it."
Harry drew the hood of the cloak over his head and glanced back up at the wall clock he'd surreptitiously glanced at earlier. It had then shown around 8:23, and now it was 9:05. Minerva stared as the boy put himself into the dueling stance, his wand held low. For a second, Minerva wondered if Harry might possibly... No, that was completely ridiculous. It was Mad-Eye Moody, and that was beyond impossible. Of course, that was what she'd thought about his partial transfiguration, too.
"Let's go, then,"
Harry said, and fell over. Severus gave a single chuckle.
"Mr. Potter has his points, I must confess," the potions master said, "though I would never say it while he was awake. And if you repeat the words, I shall deny them, for the boy's ego is quite large enough already. Mr. Potter does have his points, Mad-Eye, but dueling is not among them."
Mad-Eye's own chuckle was lower and grimmer.
"Oh, yes," said Mad-Eye. "Only fool's duel, standing like that and waiting for me to attack. What was the boy thinking? Why, I ought to give him a scar to remember this occasion."
"Alistair!"
barked Albus, just as she cried.
"Stop!"
Severus dashed forward, and Mad-Eye Moody deliberately levelled his wand on Harry Potter's body.
"Stupefy!"
Mad-Eye's body seemed to almost flicker as he spun on his wooden foot like lightning, faster than she'd ever seen anyone move without magic, the red stunning hex passing through the suddenly empty air and barely missing Severus to crash into the opposite wall. And by the time her eyes jerked back to Moody, there were 17 radiant orbs in the pattern of a Sagitta Magica, visible for only an instant before they streaked brilliance and struck something that fell to the floor with a thud.
"Hello again, Harry," said Dumbledore.
"I cannot believe that guy's reaction time,"
Harry said, brushing off his cloak as he stood up from where he'd been lying, invisible on the floor, unseen by his previous self.
"I can't believe his movement speed either. I'm going to have to figure out some way to zap him without speaking an incantation that gives it away."
And then Mad-Eye ducked hard and fast, his hands hitting flat on the floor. She almost didn't see the two tiny white threads passing through the space he'd been in, but her eyes went to the blue spark when the threads impacted on one of the headmaster's devices, and by the time she managed to turn her eyes back, Mad-Eye had spun smoothly up to his feet, his wand was dancing unseeably fast, and there was another thudding sound.
"Hello again, Harry."
Pardon me, Headmaster, but could you let me go down your stairs and then come back up again before I make the final jump backward? This is going to take longer than 1 hour of preparation."
Minerva gaped at Mad-Eye Moody, who hadn't lowered his wand in the slightest, and Severus had a look on his face that was almost like shock.
"Well, boy," said Mad-Eye Moody, "what else have you got?"
Harry Potter's head appeared, floating in mid-air as an invisible hand drew back the hood of his invisibility cloak.
"That eye," said Harry Potter. There was a strange, fierce light in the boy's eyes. "That isn't an ordinary device. It can see right through my invisibility cloak. You dodged my transfigured taser as soon as I started raising it, even though I didn't speak any incantations. And now that I've watched it again, you spotted all my time-turned selves the moment you flewed into this room, didn't you?"
Mad-Eye Moody was smiling, the same teeth-bared grin she'd seen him wear as they faced off against Voldemort himself.
"Spend 100 years hunting dark wizards, and you say everything," said Moody. "I once arrested a young Japanese who tried a similar trick. He found out the hard way that his shadow replica technique was no match for this eye of mine." "You see in all directions," Harry Potter said, that strange fierce light still in his gaze. "No matter where that eye is pointing, it sees everything around you."
Moody's tiger grin grew wider.
"There's no more of you in this room now," Mad-Eye said. "Think that's because you'll give up this time, or because you'll win? Any bets, boy?"
It's my final attempt, because I decided to stake my last 3 hours on one shot, said Harry Potter. As for whether I win...
There was a blur filling the whole air of the headmaster's office. Mad-Eye Moody leapt to one side with blinding speed, and an instant later Harry's head darted backwards as he cried,
"Stupefy!"
3 shimmers in the air went past Harry's moving head, just as a red bolt erupted from Harry's location, shooting past Moody as he dodged in yet another direction. If she'd blinked, she'd have missed it, the red bolt making an angled turn in mid-air and slamming into Moody's ear. Moody fell. Harry Potter's floating head dropped to the height of a first year on their hands and knees, then dropped further to the ground, his face showing sudden exhaustion. Minerva McGonagall said,
"What in Merlin's name just..."
"So, you went to Flitwick, then?" Moody said.
The retired Aura was now sitting in a chair, drinking long draughts from a restorative in a bottle he had taken off his belt. Harry Potter nodded, now sitting in his own chair instead of perched on an armrest.
"I tried the defense professor first, but..."
The boy grimaced.
"He... wasn't available. Well, I'd decided it was worth risking 5 house points, and if you say a risk is worth it, you can't complain when you have to pay up. Anyway, I figured that if you had an eye that saw things other people couldn't see, then, as Isaac Asimov pointed out in Second Foundation, the weapon to use is a brilliant light. Read enough science fiction, you know, and you'll read everything at least once. Anyway, I told Professor Flitwick that I needed a charm that would make a huge number of shapes, bright and flickering and filling the whole office, but invisible, so only your eye could see them. I had no idea what it would even mean to cast an illusion and then make it invisible, but I figured if I didn't mention that out loud, Professor Flitwick would just do it anyway, and he did. Turns out there was no spell like that I could cast myself, but Flitwick charmed me a one-time device for it, though I had to persuade him that it wasn't cheating, since nothing could possibly be cheating against an Aura who lived long enough to retire. And then I still didn't see how I could hit you when you were moving that fast. So I asked about targeted spells, and that was when Flitwick showed me that hex I cast at the end, the Swerving Stunner. It's one of Professor Flitwick's own inventions. He's a champion duelist as well as a charms master.
I know that, son.
Sorry. Anyway, the professor says he left the dueling circuit before he got a chance to use that spell, since it only works as a finishing move on an unshielded opponent. The hex gets as close to the target as possible along its original trajectory, and then, once it detects that the target is getting more distant again, the hex turns in mid-air and heads straight for the target. It can only swerve once, but the incantation sounds very close to stupefy, and the hex is the same red colour. So if the enemy thinks it's a regular stunning hex and tries a normal dodge, that mid-air retargeting will finish them off. Oh, and the professor requested that none of us talk about his special move, just in case he does get a chance to use it during competition someday.
But...
said Professor McGonagall. She glanced at Mad-Eye Moody, who was nodding his approval, and at Severus, who was keeping his face decidedly blank.
"Mr. Potter, you just stunned Mad-Eye Moody. the most famous dark wizard hunter in the history of the Aura Office. That should have been impossible.
Moody let out a dark chuckle.
What's your answer to that one, kid? I'm curious.
Well, Harry said, first of all, Professor McGonagall, neither of us were fighting seriously.
Neither of you?
Of course, Harry said. In a serious fight, Mr. Moody would have dropped all my copies immediately without waiting for them to attack. And on my side, if it was actually necessary to take down the most famous aura in the history of the office, I'd get Headmaster Dumbledore to do it for me. And beyond that, since that wasn't a real fight...
Harry paused.
How can I put this? Wizards are used to duels where people fight back and forth with spells for a while. But if two muggles with guns stand in a small room and fire bullets at each other, then whoever hits first wins. And if one of them is deliberately missing his shots, giving the other person one chance after another, like Mr. Moody gave me one chance after another, well, you'd have to be pretty pathetic to lose.
Oh, not that pathetic,
Moody said with a slightly threatening grin. Harry didn't seem to notice.
You might say that Mr. Moody was testing me to see if I would try to fight him or try to win. That is, whether I'd carry out the role of somebody fighting, use standard spells I already knew, even though I didn't expect the consequences of that action to be victory, or if I'd search through unusual plans until I found something that could win. Like the difference between a student who sits in class because that's what students do, versus a student who cares enough to ask themselves what it takes to actually learn a piece of material, and practices however necessary. You see, Professor McGonagall? When you look at it that way, realize that Mr. Moody was giving me chances, and that I shouldn't attack in the first place unless I think I can win. Then I don't come out looking so well, since it actually took me 3 tries to get him. Plus, like I said, in a real fight, Mr. Moody could have turned himself invisible or put up shields.
Don't go relying too much on shields, boy,
Mad-Eye Moody said. The leather-clad aura took another sip from his restorative flask.
What you learn in your first year at the Academy doesn't stay true forever. Not against the strongest dark wizards. Every shield ever made, there's some curse that goes straight through it, if you're not quick enough to cast the counter. And there's one curse that goes through everything, and it's a curse any Death Eater will use.
Harry Potter nodded gravely.
Right. Some spells are impossible to block. I'll remember that in case anyone casts the killing curse at me. Again.
That kind of cleverness gets people killed, boy. And don't you forget it.
A sad-sounding sigh from the boy who lived.
I know. Sorry.
So, son, you had something to say about when Albus and I go after Lockhart?
Harry opened his mouth, then paused.
I won't tell you how to run a war,
the boy who lived said eventually.
I don't have any experience at that. All I know is that there are consequences. Please be advised that my own assessment is that Lockhart is probably innocent, so if you can avoid hurting him without too much risk...
The boy shrugged.
I don't know the cost. Just, please, if you can, be careful not to hurt him if he's innocent.
"If I can," said Moody.
"And you're aiming to look through his mind for evidence about the Dark Lord, aren't you? I don't know what the rules are in magical Britain about admissible evidence, but everyone's always guilty of breaking some law or another. There's just too many laws. So if it's not about the Dark Lord, don't turn him into the Ministry. Just obliviate him and go, okay?"
Moody frowned. "Son, nobody gains power that fast without being up to something."
"Then leave it for the ordinary auras, if and when they find evidence the ordinary way. Please, Mr. Moody, call it a quirk of my muggle upbringing, but if it's not about the war, I don't want us to be the evil police who break into people's houses in the middle of the night, rummage through their minds, and send them off to Azkaban."
"I don't see the sense of it, son, but I suppose I could do you the favour."
"Is there aught else, Alistair?"
inquired Albus.
"Yes," said Moody. "About that defence professor of yours."
Hypothesis, Dumbledore, April 9th, 1992, 5:32 p.m.
As Professor Quirrell slowly raised up his tea, the teacup jerked in mid-air, sending the dark translucent liquid just barely slopping over the side, so that only three single drops crawled down the side of the teacup. Harry would have missed it, if he hadn't happened to be watching closely, for Professor Quirrell's hand was perfectly steady on the cup before and after.